Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
It has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
a big step!
Oh,
brother!
Lead Toledo, Ernest. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead!
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast at HardwickParoxysm.com. I'm Jason Mann, and with me as usual is Rich Kreich. Rich Kreich, back with you.
Yes.
So we, big things keep happening in the world of the NBA.
Just let us do our 70s project, NBA, come on.
Yes, so we will have our promised 70s project coming very soon, but first we have to talk about something really important.
Right.
Tim Duncan retired, officially announcing his retirement on July 11th, 2016. We had an inkling it was coming. There were reports that that he was going to retire. His last game in Oklahoma City, playoff game, he played the most, if not all, of the fourth quarter. Actually, helped them briefly. It looked like they were going to make a comeback, and then they end up falling by a decent large margin. And he, you know, as he was leaving the court, he got a standing ovation and lifted his hand in the air, and so that definitely, you know, was a sign that, you know, maybe he was done. But obviously, once it's official, it adds emotional resonance, and so we decided, well, we need to talk about Tim Duncan. I think it's obviously he deserves a show dedicated to his career and some interesting stories that we're going to try to dig into a lot that was written about him and find some interesting stories and anecdotes and share them with you guys.
Yeah, we set the precedent with Chauncey Billups, so now anybody that's better than Chauncey Billups that retires, we have to do a show about. So. Which I think is a pretty good barometer, right?
Okay, that's
if you're
fair.
If you're Chauncey Billups or better, you deserve a show, right? When
okay.
you retire, I think that's fair.
Yeah, Tim Duncan's quite a bit. Although Chauncey Billups is very good, but Tim Duncan quite a bit better.
That's so what I mean. Like Chauncey's a good one though, because like he's solid, but he's one of those ones that like people might not, you know, revere or whatever. I mean, Tim Duncan absolutely deserves one, but I say from here on out, anybody better than Chauncey Billups, we give him a show. So,
all right. It has been decreed.
Right.
Decreed it has been.
How you define better than Chauncey Billups, so I'll leave that up to you, Jason.
All right,
so.
That's fair. so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to get into, obviously, but, I want to just take a little bit of time to sort of talk about some of the Tim Duncan narratives and whether we think they are true or not true or true-ish. Because I think that just, you know, when you, you know, when you hear about him, you hear about, you know, his consistency, you hear about his reliability, lack of spectacular flair, but, you know, some people kind of consider him and the Spurs dull and lacking personality, especially in the early years. I think more recent years, they embraced a more pleasing style of play that made them a little bit more of a darling of most hardcore fans. But they definitely, you know, were something that, you know, for the most part, you know, they weren't appreciated or loved by the masses like, you know, the Warriors of recent vintage have been, or you know, they haven't been that transformative team that's always in the headlines like the, you know, the Lakers of the 2000s and Miami Heat of the early 2010s. So you know, but at the same time, obviously their consistency, you know, we've talked about it many times, is, you know, even going before Duncan, but certainly since Duncan has been there for 19 years, they have been basically a title contender almost every single season, you know, a threat to win a championship, lock at 50 or more wins, just, you know, one of the great, you know, Duncan and with Popovich as a coach, one of the great, you know, tandems of all time, one of the great, you know, consistent arcs, not just in NBA, but in any sport.
Yeah, no, he's definitely, I mean, there's there of course are the dull narratives and the boring narratives and all that sort of stuff, but to be fair, I think most, at least in my life, when I've surrounded myself or as I've gotten older and surrounded myself with more apt basketball fans, more apt, you know, players of basketball, people that understand basketball a little bit more, I hear that a lot less. Now, I don't know if that's still like kind of a national narrative, because I try to ignore a lot of like the terrible national narratives and stuff. But I do remember, of course, and I think we all remember when they first came into the league, or when Duncan first came into the league and the Spurs, kind of until about maybe 2005-ish or so, there was that talk about him. And you know what? To be fair, it's honestly not like, yeah, it's not a horribly unwarranted thing, because they did play a very boring, but you yeah. know, a kind of a boring, dull brand of basketball, even if it wasn't Duncan specifically that was doing it. But
yeah, and in fairness, like, it was a time where the league had gotten
that's
a little
my
bit.
Point was going to be, it was a boring yeah. ass league too. Like, it was yeah. like, yes, Duncan and the Spurs yeah. were the you know, the top dogs, but it was a all around boring league. I mean, yes, you had like your few guys, or you know, your Vince Carters, your Tracy McGrady's, and a few guys like that, even Kobe and Shaq to an extent. But a lot of your best teams, and of course the Kings and the Mavs were coming up a little bit, but a lot of the really good teams kind of played a boring, plotting yeah. brand of basketball, and the Spurs were one of those teams.
Yeah, they were slow it down, grind it out, play yeah. great defense. I mean, and there's something to be appreciated for that, too. I think I don't think everything was dull at that point, but it was definitely a slower game. It was definitely, you know, a lot of, one-on-one, a lot of, you know, throwing it, you know, into the low post and, you know, letting a guy get his move. And, you know, it wasn't the kind of, yeah, obviously, you know, they had the rule changes for a reason to open up the game to, you know, and it obviously worked out very well. It's a faster paced, more scoring game. You know, most people I think like it better now. There are some diehards who like the who like the old ways, but I think it is to the credit of Duncan and the Spurs that they were able to, you know, change their style of play in an effective way. I mean, you know, Duncan for the first half of his career was very much that, you know, you go to him in the low post and he has these great low post moves. He has these great, you know, he's got that bank shot. He's got, you know, he's got a great jumper and everything. It's very, you know, there's nothing, you know, I mean, it's spectacular in a sense because it is just, you know, incredible for a guy to be that skilled and to play that way. But there's nothing like stand out, like, you know, that's just going to like inspire like, you know, oh my God, I can't believe he just did that. That's not something he did very often. You know, he lacked that. He lacked that flair, and there's nothing wrong with that. He's obviously incredibly effective, and won five championships for his career, four in the from 99 to 2007 for in nine seasons. So obviously a great success during that time, but it was a throughout his career he was, you know, I think in a lot of these I think it contains truth, but it sort of tends to oversimplify like who he was and what he did. You know, the other thing is the argument of was he a power forward or a center? And
I hate this argument.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I would argue that probably he was sort of somewhere in between, maybe right. 4.5, you could say, you know, because he did
at various times. Yeah, it was depending who else was on. It's a very fluid thing, and in a lot of ways, of course, this has now become a little bit more the norm for a lot of players, and we sort of, I think, less and less, and at least in our lifetimes, I think there'll become a point where people aren't so as rigid with, oh, he's a point guard, he's a power forward, he's a center. I think LeBron's doing a great job of sort of breaking that because he's kind of all over the place. But yeah, I always had this idea with Duncan that, well, it depends who he's with on the court. Yes, if David Robinson's on the court, he's probably a power forward. If Malik Rose is on the court, well, he's maybe a center then. Like, you know, it's not like, or Tiago Splitter, okay, now he's back to a power. Like, he was able to do both. I kind of always defined him as that tweener, like you said, a 4.5, if you want. That's always been how I've at least viewed him, and this argument has always kind of infuriated me, because who cares just...
yeah, and I think there's a different position for what he did. There's these in-between guys who weren't, you know, like, they're not, you know, they're not quite Shaq, obviously, as a center. They're not just playing to the back of the basket, but they're also, you know, they have center skills. They can defend most centers. They can, you know, defend most power forwards. He could defend, you know, I mean, he was really, obviously, one of his great skills was his incredible versatility as a defender, being able to defend in the post and being able to, you know, to get out in the perimeter and to, you know, to handle switches and things like that, which he did, you know, incredibly well for, you know, up until kind of last year of his career when he started to slow down a little bit, even though he, you know, the Spurs were historically great defense and he had an incredibly great defensive rating, but you could tell a little bit that he had, you know, some of the things like the, especially against Golden State, he had a tough time, you know, with the switching on the pick and rolls and things like that at that point. But the other thing to me is that, you know, there's the idea of, you know, the selflessness, the lack of ego, you know, being understated, being you know, and whether it's certainly true that he was not a guy who was, you know, out there bragging a whole lot. He was not a guy who was he didn't do a whole lot of in-depth interviews, didn't really share his personality. So he did definitely had that, and he definitely, unlike almost every single superstar in sports, he didn't really use his power in a way that was anything other than pretty much benevolent. I mean, he's generally regarded as just an incredible teammate, but I do think, like, I think it's important to say that, like, he did have an ego. He was respected as a leader. He did, you know, he had that, you know, he wasn't just this, like, you know, meek kind of, guy who just deferred to everyone. I mean, he commanded that leadership. He commanded that team. And he also could be very biting and sarcastic in his humor, which, you know, was actually one thing that he was, you know, that that people generally liked about
him. Right, and a reason why he probably got along with Mr. Popovich for many years, because he's a very similar guy. One thing I did want to mention, you had mentioned before the talk about him sort of being dull and lacking personality on the court or whatever, and we're going to find some quotes, and we found some quotes as we're kind of going through this research, and we'll talk about them, I'm sure, during the show, that a lot of players said that was kind of intimidating in a lot of ways, because they were so used to people being, you know, braggadocious and bold and colorful, and, like, Duncan just kind of did his thing. He just kind of stood there and looked at, like, there's one story of Draymond Green who's like, he's like talking crap to him, and Duncan just stares at him, and Draymond's just like, oh, all right, and then just doesn't, and then Draymond says, I never talk crap to him again, because it was just like, oh, well, it doesn't affect him at all. Doesn't, like, to some people that really does work, like that sort of stoicness and that sort of seriousness had people in a lot of ways respect him even more on the court. It worked to his advantage of being that way, and it's you know, it's probably not very far from what he is, but we have seen him be a little bit more playful. But when he was on the court, he was kind of a very stoic, dull person, but he used that absolutely to his advantage, because then he'd burst out of nowhere and hit you with, you know, a great hook shot, and you'd be like, ah, damn. And then, you know, he'd have 35 points and 20 rebounds, and you'd be, you know, he always seemed to have that knack of, like, and I was talking with a few buddies about this, is that you would watch a game with the Spurs, and you would know that Duncan was having a really good game, but it wouldn't be almost until the end that you would be like, oh my god, he had, like, you know, 35 and 20, or he had 40 points, you know what I mean? Like, I was watching highlights of his 53-point game, because so many of his points come in, like, a very, you know, they're hook shots, they're kind of these bank shots, they're nothing spectacular about any of the shots that he's making. They're just, like, you know, very good, very crisp, very, you know, smart fundamental shots that you sort of get lost in the moment, and then when the game's over, you don't even realize how many points and how big of an impact he had on that particular game. I do remember that so many times with Duncan, but then there are other times as well, like the 2003 the game six, you know, the final game of David Robinson. That was a very obvious, you know, Duncan saying, I am going to win this game, I'm taking over this game, and we're going to dominate. And there were plenty of games where he had that as well, but I thought that one of the more interesting things of him is that he would so quietly dominate a game.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk about the stoic demeanor on the court, but the one time, or the times he was not stoic was when he was complaining about calls to referees, which was quite often. I always loved that, you know, those big eyes would come out, and, you know, he would just the
greatest shrug ever. Yeah, his shrug was the best. Like, he'd put his head down and shrug. Like,
and just the incredulousness that would be in his face as when, you know, a call would go in his way. I mean, I've heard people joke that, you know, Tim Duncan, you know, he did all these things but never committed a foul, you know, and at least according to him. So that obviously goes against the stoicism idea, but yeah, he was very much like, he even talked about how, you know, he tried to kind of maintain that demeanor on the court. Not, he thought that, you know, if people didn't see what affected him, then it would rattle them, or at least at the very least they wouldn't feel like they had an advantage on him. So and obviously he was very effective in his career. So we're gonna share some interesting Tim Duncan stories that we found throughout his throughout his life and career. He started out as a swimmer and actually only began playing basketball in the ninth grade after Hurricane Hugo destroyed the only Olympic-sized pool on his home, which is in St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And they started practicing in the ocean, but he was afraid of the sharks, so he decided to switch to basketball instead.
I'm with you, Tim. Yeah, I'm with you, Tim. I too curtailed my Olympic swim hopefulness because of my I was so afraid of sharks as well. So
there you go.
Yeah, because also Hurricane Hugo also affected Chicago's Olympic sized pool.
Sure.
So yeah. So that me and him always had that connection from the almost from the very
well,
beginning.
Well, that's so good. You know, he actually promised his mother he would graduate from college before she died of breast cancer one day before he turned 14. So that was the reason he decided to stay at Wake Forest for all 4 years. He basically the last all-time great player to play, you know, 4 years in college. Probably going to be the last Hall of Famer. You know, there may be somebody, you know, here and there who kind of comes. You know, Damian Lillard, for instance. I think he did you do 4 years in college? I think he may have. But,
I don't know off the top of my head. I'm sure someone will correct us.
There probably is, like, somebody. But as far as, like, it's certainly rare. I mean, he was kind of the last of the breed of those guys.
Yeah,
you know,
and Lillard, people knew about him, but he sort of came out of nowhere in a sense, where Tim Duncan, almost from the time he was, like, a sophomore, people were like, this guy is really good, he is great. We'll talk about a story here in a little bit where people are like, dude, you're ready, like, whenever you want to come, and he didn't. And so that is going to be the rare thing of, like, that guy that, like, everybody knows as a sophomore, even as a freshman now, because guys advance so much quicker now. Even as a freshman, you know this guy is great, you know he's awesome, you know he's going to be a top five pick, and yet he hangs around for all 4 years. That is not going to happen. Like, a guy like a Damian Lillard, yeah, he might, or there's going to be other guys that kind of come out of nowhere, go into the league and do well, but you're never going to – I really just do not think you're going to get that guy that – as a freshman, as a sophomore, people know he's great, and he just stays like that. I don't think so.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I didn't know
Lillard was all 4 years. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt. But
okay,
yes,
there you go.
So
yes,
nobody has to correct us. We corrected ourselves. There you go.
Yes. So I didn't know this story, but he had a battle on the court with Alonzo Mourning when he was 16 years old. It actually got the better of Alonzo.
Yeah, that was it's a really good story. Yeah, there's a quote from the Washington Post that actually talks about this. This was in yesterday, I think it came out yesterday, this article. NBA player agent Bob Kingsley arranged a tour for NBA players to raise money and awareness following a spate of violence in the Virgin Islands. So the team, they gathered a bunch of guys. They basically couldn't get anybody great because, like, not many guys wanted to come do this. But Alonzo Mourning did. So and he was kind of a big star at that point, or at least budding
Absolutely.
Into a star.
Yeah,
so
he was, yeah.
So,
a big star at that point.
Yeah, so hey, we got Zoe. Cool. Nice. So we're going to go to the Virgin Islands, play these random guys that are going to be no good, and we'll get out of here. But that did not happen, because inside of the packed gym, Duncan matched up against Mourning early on in the game. This is the article of Washington Post again. Early on in the game, Duncan caught a pass on the block, turned, squared up, and banked a shot in over Mourning. The rest of the night, Duncan reportedly dominated Mourning. King figured Mourning was going to go through the motions in a charity game, but Duncan's performance still blew him away. So, of course, there was still this idea that Mourning was kind of going through the motions. But still, I mean, at a certain point, you know, you score a few times on an NBA guy, and he's probably going to go, you know, I'm gonna get going here. But it didn't happen here. Here's a quote as well from the article. He's playing against Alonzo Mourning. He's 16. He's dominating this guy. He's running the floor. He has these great hands. I was like, oh, my God, this kid can play.
Yeah, and that's obviously it's interesting, of course, because he started at 14, so he at 16
right.
years old, you know, he grew a lot in, you know, he grew like 9 inches in 3 years, so because he kind of started off learning the game as a guard, and then grew to the point where he became a big man. Obviously, showing those kind of skills during his career as well, but another thing I think that stands out is that Duncan would very likely have been the number one pick in 95 and 96 if he had gone early, but Duncan assured everyone that he had no intention of going pro until he graduated, even though the NBA was planning to add a rookie salary cap in 96. So he there was a lot of money that he could have gotten if he had left early. So that even, you know, stands out even more, the fact that he decided to, you know, go to school, you know, and go to school, leave early, you know, whatever. For, it's obviously everybody's individual decision, but I think just the fact that he, even though he had that incentive to stay, to not stay, the fact that he stayed, I think, was, is pretty special.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, like I was mentioning before, he was a guy that people knew. I mean, I remember watching him even as a kid, and because, you know, at that time I watched a lot more college basketball than I do now, but I remember seeing him as a junior and a sophomore, and it just being this idea that, like, this guy is very good, like, and that had become, you know, the stay 4 years and, you know, live out your college and, you know, win some national titles, like, that had pretty much passed at this point. You know, of course, in this era, we're starting to get into the early days of, you know, Kevin Garnett coming out of, you know, high school, Kobe Bryant coming out of high school, guys leaving. I mean, that it had basically that floodgate had sort of opened of guys coming in and being good players right off the bat as well, because there had always been that sort of phobia about you know, younger guys or underclassmen or whatever. So this idea that you get a big man like Duncan, who's as polished as he was and pretty much ready to go at that point, like you said, he was the top pick both of those years, and for him to stay and leave that money and do all that, it's admirable. And of course, you know, knowing that he did it so that he could get his degree, which he promised his mother, just adds another different element to it. So
yeah. And and at Wake Forest, Tom Haberstroh tweeted that a link to he published a paper in a psychology journal. He majored in psychology. The title is Blowhards, Snobs, and Narcissists: Interpersonal Reactions to Excessive Egotism, which I guess is useful for the NBA.
Absolutely, yeah. The opening line of that chapter is, few interactions are as annoying, exacerbating, and unpleasant as those with people whom we perceive are behaving egotistically. So
there you go.
The perfect Tim Duncan, you know, term paper. Yes. is that right there, and I fully. You know, I could just see him on his. I'm trying to think. What are you in 1996? What are you typing? I guess you'd type on an early computer, right? Like,
sure.
Tim Duncan had a sweet computer in 1996.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, whatever Apple was going on.
Yeah, exactly.
The small little ones that were gray and like lime green, you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. With the handle in the back. Yeah, I see him in like a very small chair too. It's like a very small chair, small computer with like his legs on his knees, his like knees facing his nose, and he's just typing. You know, ah, damn it! I hate egotistical people. And yeah, it's perfect for old Timmy.
There you go. Yes. So and you know, he was NBA ready from the moment he stepped under the floor in 1997. In only his third game ever, he scored 19 points and 22 rebounds against the two-time defending champion Bulls. So
His game logs of that opening year are like go look at him. If you're with me right now, and if you're listening to the show right now, go look at him. I mean, it's incredible how quickly he was like, yeah, I'm ready to go and I'm good. Like, you know, 15 and 10 his first game. Yeah. Then he has 9. Then he has 19, 19, 8, 15, 22, 19, 20. And then, like, it's basically off and running. And then I don't think he scores single digits, like, once more after his first week. And it's, like, it's just ridiculous. Like,
yeah.
And then he's scoring 20 a game, you know, from then on. Like, it was just, like, there was no – it just hit the ground running. Absolutely. Like, from the first game he stepped on the court, from the first moment he stepped on the court, he belonged and he never didn't belong. And that's something that I think is pretty remarkable about Duncan, is that even in that final year, which you're saying, you know, it was kind of waning a little bit, but there never was a point where he was on the court and you were like, oh no, the team is worse for him being, you know, there was never ever that, where we see that with a lot of legendary players where they have their final year. I mean, you know, people are gonna get mad, but Kobe Bryant, a lot of this last year was like, okay, I can, like, all right, like, you know, it's okay, Kobe, you're not great, but keep shooting the ball. I mean, keep doing it. Duncan never, we never did that. He stepped on the court, he was great, and he left the court, and he was still good. So it's like, it's remarkable in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, he had his struggles kind of later in the season in the playoffs. Other than, you know, blips here and there, he basically. You know, you looked at, I mean, it's amazing. You look at like the per minute numbers of his first and his last season, and they're extremely close. Like the per 36, you know, everything scoring, rebounding, you know, basically everything, shooting percentage, all that stuff, was, you know, at a very similar range from his first season to his last season. So 1999, I had kind of forgotten how dominant they were throughout that playoff series, because, you know, when Duncan comes to the Spurs, you know, the only reason they were bad in 97 was because they had held David Robinson and Sean Elliott out with injuries, and you know, who are the two best players? Robinson obviously being a superstar, and once they, you know, once those guys were healthy and they brought in Duncan, they were, you know, ready to be a you know, a 50-win perennial team and possible championship contender, and then they would win the finals their second year. And yeah, they beat the Timberwolves 3-1. They swept the Lakers and the Blazers, and then defeated the Knicks 4-1 in the finals. Now the Knicks, you know, were famously the 8th seed. They were not a good regular season team, so they were, you know, a fairly easy team to beat. But you know, the Western Conference was pretty tough that year. I mean, the Lakers and the Blazers were not they were not nothing. That was Shaq and Kobe pre Phil Jackson, and you know, that was a Trailblazers team that had a lot of that had a lot of good players. That, you know, that was the year before, of course, they faced the Lakers in that famous 2000 series. So, they were able to kind of wipe through those teams in pretty impressive fashion, only losing two games in that series. And, you know, and Duncan, of course, had a pretty astute was pretty stout throughout those entire playoffs.
Yeah, first round, just quick little averages looking at his points per game and rebounds. The first round, he averaged 18.8 points per game and 10.8 rebounds per game, so not bad. Second round against the Lakers, 29 points per game and 10.8 rebounds per game, so not bad again. Also, the same rebounds per game in the first and second round, which is perfect. A lot of .8s in this one. I don't know why he was very had a propensity for .8 averages here. Third round, 16, as you're going to guess, .8 points per game. And 9, you're going to guess this, .8 rebounds. I'm not joking. I don't know how these happen like that. But and then he turned it on definitely for the NBA Finals. 27.4 points per game and 14 rebounds per game en route to being the Finals MVP. And he was the second youngest at age 23 in NBA history to win the Finals MVP, just behind Magic Johnson.
Yes. So, so that, you know, obviously they would they would kind of fall back behind the Lakers for the next few seasons. The Lakers won the championships in 2000, 2001, and 2002. They would battle in two of those playoffs, as I recall. And the Spurs would get some revenge in the 2003 season. They would win the championship. Robinson and Duncan were co-named Sports Illustrated's 2003 Sportsman of the Year. I checked to see how common it is for multiple people to win Sports Men of the Year, and this actually is fairly common. So it wasn't that unique for them to do so. But that was David Robinson's final season. It obviously had transitioned to be Duncan's team. It really had almost immediately from when Duncan came in. It was kind of his team, but although Robinson was still obviously very important to that, but obviously that made the difference, since they were, you know, just a pretty good team before Duncan came in, and then became what they were after that. Interestingly enough, and I had kind of forgotten this, but Jason Kidd apparently agreed to sign with the Spurs in free agency after that season in 2003, and then decided he had second thoughts and decided to go back to the Nets and for this big contract. And those teams had matched up in the finals in 2003. You wonder. Obviously, the Spurs had a lot of success. Won, they won the 05 and 07 titles after that. But you wonder if Kidd had been there, if they had been even stronger, if they had won some back to back or three in a row type things. I mean, that would have been an incredible powerhouse team.
Yeah, the interesting part about that you sort of have to think, because I look at it on the flip side of it. I look at, you have Jason Kidd on that team, and that obviously he had been, a perennial, NBA Finals contender in the East and coming to the Spurs, and great point guard, obviously. But then you also look at the idea that, then you what happens to Tony Parker? Where does Tony Parker become? And there was some value in Tony Parker being very good and then also being, much more affordable than a Jason Kidd, whereas now that team had a lot of extra money because you had a Parker who wasn't commanding that much money, where it would have been interesting to see if that maybe then the bench suffers by not having as much money, because you have a kid in there, and that was a big deal, and that's something that the Spurs, haven't really done much, is like that big free agent deal. They've just kind of been able to, smartly draft and smartly acquire guys from various different, parts of the universe and the world or whatever.
A lot of reclamation projects.
Yeah, exactly. So that's been great. But so it'd been very interesting, because that changes the whole dichotomy of the Spurs in the mid 2000s. If you have this guy on a big money contract that's taking up a bunch of your cap, even if he's a great player and even if he's awesome, it's just kind of it's just a whole different team and a whole different dynamic.
Yeah, and you wonder, of course, about Tony Parker development there. Yeah, I mean, it could have not gone that well. I mean, I tend to think it might. It probably would have, at least in the next 3 or 4 years. Of course, you wonder if they're able to kind of rebuild themselves the way that they did after, 2008, 2009, and recast themselves. And, that would have changed a whole lot of things. So it might have helped them win another ring here and there, but it may have, prevented them from being able to do future things down the line. It may have changed Parker's career course. He may not have stuck around. A lot of things to think about there. But the fact that he actually expressed regret to not joining the team in 2003 was a little bit of a surprise to me. He had some success with the Nets, and obviously he would win a title in Dallas. But given, kind of all the kvetching about Durant joining the Warriors, I thought it was interesting, mm-hmm. the fact that, Kidd came so close to even agreeing to join the Spurs before backing out on that.
And one thing we should mention before we move on is Duncan, because we kind of went over this, is Duncan in, 99-2000 having the opportunity to leave the Spurs and sign with Orlando there were plenty of teams, but Orlando apparently had, the best offer, a multi-year deal, big money. And he even said that they made it very difficult. They wind and dined him. They talked about building, this power team with him and Grant Hill and all these guys. Hill eventually, of course, did move on from the Pistons to go to the Magic, but Duncan did stay with the Spurs, of course, and created that legacy. But that's a whole different animal if he becomes an Orlando Magic, and it's I think that team would have been pretty awesome because you have Tim Duncan and Grant Hill, and eventually you'd get Tracy McGrady or whatever. But it's another interesting little wrinkle of just this one little thing changing two decades worth of the NBA is just crazy.
Yeah, and I like there's an anecdote about Duncan and Popovich staying up late drinking beers in Pop's backyard, talking the situation through before Duncan decided to come back. But yeah, I mean that looked like a very appealing thing. Because they were getting Grant Hill and Tracy McGrady, that looked like that was going to be a real powerhouse. And the Spurs didn't. That was after the 99 season. That was pre Ginobili, pre Parker. They didn't necessarily have they were a pretty old team other than Duncan. So, it looked like they were going to have.
And the West wasn't getting any easier either. I mean, that's right. Another thing
yeah,
too.
Exactly.
You look at we talked
was,
about the year prior how they went through the Portland and the Lakers. Well, the Lakers had figured it out, and of course were on their way to some great dominant years. Portland was still super talented. Then you have Sacramento emerging with Weber starting to kind of find his footing in there, and Dallas starting to get something going as well. So I look at that Western Conference and I look at the Eastern Conference and I'm like, I think I'm gonna go over there. That a little bit more.
Yeah, and obviously Timberwolves were emerging with Garnett.
Yeah, of course.
Jazz with Stockton Malone were still powerhouse right at the end of that. So that would have it would have been understandable if he had left. And obviously things worked out. But that was also a pretty close decision on Duncan's part from all accounts. Another thing that was another very close call was the famous Derek Fisher shot of 0.4 seconds remaining, which knocked the Spurs out. The final Lakers and Spurs playoff matchup of the Kobe Shaq era, and with the Lakers winning 3-2. Kobe Duncan actually had a fadeaway shot of his own that looked like the game winner because again there was so little time left.
0.4 seconds, you got this.
Yeah.
You're good. How do you get a shot off in 0.4 seconds?
Well. Right, and of course that would have the Spurs would have been able to if they gotten by the Lakers they would have been able to win the series. They had a good chance of winning the championship there against the Pistons, and they had a good chance of winning 3 in a row. And instead they of course the one small mark against Duncan is the lack of back-to-back titles, although you're really
stretching there.
Yeah,
buddy. Yeah,
exactly.
Hypothetical person, you're just stop
yes. So.
But yeah, that's a good case point in that. Yes, maybe he didn't win back by titles, but this was a very good opportunity that he lost. And then you look at other things there's a realistic chance if you do a few. I mean, of course you can do this with a lot of people, but if there's a realistic chance if you kind of move some things here and there and look at 2006, there was that if I remember the key play in that series. I think Dirk went for a drive, and like Manu just for whatever, like Dirk is already like inches from the basket, and I think Manu just like pushes him in the back, and like Dirk gets an and-one, and that's a big reason why the Mavericks, you know, beat them in 2006. So you can look at a case where like the Spurs are in like five straight NBA finals and have an actual realistic chance of winning like five straight NBA titles, which is crazy. But then it ended up, you know, they didn't win any in a row, which is just again like just as crazy it is. And of course, again, you can do that with a bunch of little things, but we look at very like very super specific plays that really knock them out or whatever. So it's just really interesting.
Yeah, very small margins of these things from, you know, being an even greater achievement. And we don't want to overdo that because obviously, you know, their achievements are incredible on the face. But, you know, it is an interesting thought exercise. One probably disappointing aspect of Duncan's career is that he was never able to win Olympic gold. He was injured in 2000. He missed the playoffs that year as well. That's one reason why they were not able to repeat that year. And in 2004, they had you know, one of the great lack of fit teams with Iverson and Marbury and just not just kind of having a mishmash of guys that were talented but just didn't fit, lacked cohesion because they hadn't had much practice time together, and Larry Brown not necessarily the most suitable coach for that squad, and they ended up. They ended up with the Browns, and after the tournament...
Wait a minute. Are you calling into question Larry Brown's patience with something? Hold on. Hold on a minute. I will not even hear it. I won't hear it.
Yes. So
that is SMU legend Larry Brown. Oh, wait. Sorry. He quit. Sure. He just quit last week. Sorry. Never mind. Yeah. I take it back.
After the tournament, Duncan said, "I'm about 95% sure my FIBA career is over. I'll try not to share my experiences with anyone." So...
And he never got back, which is great. He never won Olympic gold, Tim Duncan, ever.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a huge regret for him, but he only was able, he only had those opportunities, I'm actually kind of surprised he didn't go 96. Did they have a college choice in 96? I feel like they did, but.
Let me see what the 96 Olympic team was. Yeah, I don't remember. I'm sure they had a college. They always had like a token college guy.
I think 96 was last year they had a token college guy, but I could be wrong.
No, there's no token college guy in the 96.
Oh,
well,
there
team,
you
I
go.
Guess.
All
yeah,
right.
So Christian Laettner was too much for them to handle. Like, all right, well, forget it. Like,
no one can follow that.
Yeah, we'll just have Mitch Richmond instead of like some terrible college guy. So yeah,
there
no problem.
So one great Duncan story is in 2006 he paid Brent Berry $100 to kiss David Stern at a ring ceremony honoring the Spurs 2005 championship, and then he kissed him on the cheek and Duncan gave him $100. So that's a great story.
And there is video evidence if you want to look this up too. If you look up 2005, you know, Spurs ring ceremony, you can find it on YouTube. So
yes, so there you go. And then another amusing anecdote, although maybe it didn't seem amusing to him at the time, was of course the famous Joey Crawford ejecting Duncan, who was laughing on the bench, laughing about a call that went against the Spurs.
Yeah, this is a great one, and it actually did play like a pivotal part in that season, because I think the Spurs like lost the two seed, or like in that game, I think if they had won, they would have gotten the two seed in the playoffs, but then they lost or whatever. But it was April 2007. Duncan was called for his first technical foul with about 2:20 remaining in the third. He was arguing, you know, as we mentioned, as he was wont to do, an offensive foul. Crawford hit him with the second technical, though, a minute and 16 later when Duncan was on the bench laughing about a call that went against the Spurs. And there's a great video of this as well. I actually looked up an article from that actual time, because I know Joey Crawford got like suspended for it and like got really reprimanded. And Duncan had a quote. I'm sure it was part of why Joey Crawford got suspended. The NBA, I'm sure, trusted Duncan here. But yeah, it's a really telling thing. So Duncan says, he looked at me and he said, "Do you want to fight? Do you want to fight? If he wants to fight, we can fight. I don't have any problem with him, but we can do it if he wants to. I have no reason why in the middle of the game he would yell at me, 'Do you want to fight?'" So, like, I like the idea that, like, well, I don't really want to fight him, but if he wants to, I will. Like,
yeah.
Like, I mean, and that's more of, like, Duncan humor in a way, but it's still... It's a very funny, weird, but there's a great video of this on YouTube as well, where Duncan just is cannot believe it, and Pop just blows a gasket. He's like, "What are you? Are you kidding me?" And I know there is a quote too that Joey Crawford in that article, if you look it up, will say that he thinks he coached his final game and that the NBA is going to fire him after this, but that did not happen.
No. Yes. Refereed his final game. Right. He was suspended for it, and he eventually apologized for it, and let his anger get the better of him, and then cooler heads eventually prevailed. But it was it was definitely an odd situation at the time. So, another great one is from 2012, March 24th, where prior to the game against the 76ers, head coach Greg Popovich decided to give Duncan a night off by listing him as DMP old, poking fun at his 36-year-old body, which I think is a I actually forgotten specifically that DMP old happened. Like, I remember, like, DMP old jokes, but I forgot the actual origin of that joke was Popovich poking fun at Duncan. So that was a great one. By the way, in one thing that one fun thing about Tim Duncan, maybe people know a bit, but Tim Duncan loves paintball.
Yeah, so this is an article that you absolutely have to read. I think I'm trying to find the exact one. I believe it was ProjectSpurs.com that did this article, and this is a few years ago. They talked about his paintball escapades, but I'm going to read from this article just to give you an idea. Yeah. And then we have, I think, the greatest story ever with Steven Jackson and Tim Duncan, which we'll get to in a sec.
I think this may be a couple of different ones, because one of them is definitely from the Chris Ballard article on Duncan, which we'll talk about.
Okay, so we might be mixing up too. But anyway, here's the quote. Again, I don't remember exactly which one this was, but it says, did he once invite a bunch of teammates to go to a paintball course, even though most had never played paintball? Perhaps. Did Duncan then stack his team with ringers and bring his own high-powered paintball gun? Maybe. Did he give certain players, such as Danny Ferry, guns that, according to Ferry, were bent and shot 6 feet to the left every time? There's a chance. And did Duncan then take great delight in hunting down his teammates, chasing the pale, balding, short-term Ferry until he was in close range, at which point Duncan unleashed a hail of water-soluble hellfire upon the man? It's possible. And Michael Finley has a quote here. It says, quote, he invited the whole team out for paintball once, but I never played. I called him to ask what we have to wear. He said long pants and a long sleeve shirt so it can protect you from the paint. But he showed up in a tank top, shorts, and knee pads. When I asked him why, he said, well, I'm not going to get hit. That's great. And then...
The Steven Jackson one is great.
The greatest story ever, yeah.
He told this on the Grantland Basketball Hour.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And he, he said, he basically just... he and Duncan snuck out to play paintball. Popovich actually told them not to go, and it was 2 days before camp, and we went anyway, and he said it was all Tim's idea, if you can believe this, Tim's idea to go against Pop. So we go, and I'm one of those guys not afraid to get shot at. I've been shot at many times in my life, so paintball bullets don't bother me at all, right? So he accidentally – so he's wearing a mask and didn't realize that the mask could fog up. And so he ends up tripping over or slipping on a first steps. He hit his mouth, and then blood just starts shooting everywhere. So he tries to run off the field and holding his mouth. He's just getting shot at, and then he gets to Tim, and Tim's like, oh, how am I going to tell Pop? And and he's like freaking out about it. So they made up something that he was like at the club, and then he made up some excuse where no one was around but me, and I took one for the team. So,
I like the idea that in Steven Jackson's world and in Tim Duncan's world, which it's very fair, is that instead of saying we played paintball, it makes more sense that Steven Jackson like got in a fight at a club, and like anybody, like Pop would have been more fine with that than you were playing paintball. What are you doing? Versus I was in a club and I got punched. So, oh, okay, whatever. It's Steven Jackson. Like Steven Jackson's my favorite ever. Like I went to a bunch of articles as well. I got in this like Steven Jackson wormhole, and then my favorite quote ever about Steven Jackson, maybe my favorite quote of in NBA history, is Steven Jackson got interviewed after the Gilbert Arenas Javaris Crittenden issue, of course, with the guns in the locker room and that sort of stuff. And Steven Jackson had the greatest quote with that. He said, "Man, guns in the locker room, I wouldn't even do that." And the way he said it was like, like the I wouldn't, like, whoa, like that's even beyond me, and I'm Steven Jackson, like, you know, like, man, like how, like that. It's just one of my favorite quotes in NBA history. So I just like this one as well. Of course, I'm not afraid to get shot at. I've been shot at many times in real life, so paintball bullets don't bother me at all.
Yeah, And there's another one. Yeah, there's another one with Jackson, because, you know, he had two stints on the team. He had a stint, you know, kind of early in the 2000s. Was I think he was on their 0-3 championship team, and then, you know, the story about paintball was from later, when he, you know, he was a veteran on the you know, on the 13 and 14 years. But talking about where, you know, they early on, where you know, Jackson would get frustrated Popovich, and when he would get benched, and then he would, you know, he would curse, and, you know, get really mad, and would, you know, fans in the stands would hear it, and it, you know, when it got too much, Duncan would approach Popovich and say, "I got him," and then, you know, he would take him aside, and they would sort of, you know, joke and hang around, and they were actually, you know, made sort of an odd couple. Duncan was one of the squarest players in the year, and Jackson, who never met a club he couldn't close down, a team he couldn't tear apart, or a bottle he couldn't pop. So that was also from the Tim Duncan 21 Shades of Grey article by Chris Ballard, which came out in 2012. So, but yeah, so one fun thing, a couple of interesting numbers things. Duncan is the oldest player to record a 2020 game in history. He had 23 points and 21 rebounds and the game-winning jump shot against the Hawks in December 12th, 2013. And in 2014, when Duncan won his fifth title with the Spurs, he joined John Sally as the only players to win a championship in three different decades. And
one of those things is not like the other.
In 26, yes, exactly. Yeah, right. Not that John Sally's a bad player, but yeah, there's a little slight difference between the two.
We would not do a show if we had went back and I forgot what year John Sally retired. But if we were doing a real player media podcast at that point, I don't think we would have done one on John Sally. So
probably not. No. I don't think that would have happened.
If we had distributed WAV files or real media files on our weird website at that point, yes. I don't think we would have done that. So.
So he had the most consecutive games with 1 point that ended in 2016, 1359 in a row. And he had, was the third player in NBA history on April 5th, in fact, right before the end of the season, he was the third player to earn 1,000 wins in his career, joining Kareem and Robert Parrish. Let's see. So some other things worth noting. He his quote on the idea of being boring. We talked about this before, but the actual quote I think is interesting. If you show excitement, then you also may show disappointment or frustration. If your opponent picks up on this frustration, you are at a disadvantage. So, and describing his own personality, he compared himself to Will Hunting in Good Will Hunting. I'm just a taller, slightly less hyperactive version of the Damon character in that movie. I really enjoyed how he probed people and found their weaknesses just by asking questions and stating outlandish remarks.
Yeah, which I could see it. I could absolutely see it. So.
I hadn't thought of about that. There's a few good. There was an SI Extra Mustard article with these 23 facts prove Tim Duncan is actually the most entertaining man in the NBA. A few brief ones. He is a big Dungeons and Dragons fan. He's also a big video game player. He acknowledges a certain joy of playing himself in basketball video
which
games.
Is terrible. He's terrible. Like, yes. Playing as the Spurs. Like, anybody that's like a veteran NBA 2K player, like, nobody plays as the Spurs. Like, you can't really mimic the style. And, like, who plays as Tim? Like, who wants to play as Tim Duncan on a video game? Like, other than Tim Duncan, which yeah, I could absolutely see him doing as well. Just, like, sitting down and, like, taking, like, because he would still take, like, very fundamental shot, you know what I mean? Like, he would, like, very much set up an offense, and, like, I'm sure playing with him is just, like, an absolute joy. It's just, like, you know, there's no, you know, he doesn't hit the turbo button, he just kind of slowly gets down there and sets a pick and, like, goes in the low block and then, like, makes a shot, and he's, like, very happy about it. You know, he's good to go. So I like the idea that he unwinds by playing as himself on a video game, which is pretty good.
Yes, so
he also
so
likes Renaissance fairs too.
Yeah, exactly. And he has tattoos of Merlin and a spooky skeleton gesture. And he actually there's an ESPN article where he wanted his nickname initially to be Merlin, but his teammates were like, not so much.
Right. Thank you, Vinny Del Negro, for not letting him be that, because that would have been really bad. So.
Yes. So that's nice.
How is there no pictures of Tim Duncan at a Renaissance Fair? If he supposedly loves these Renaissance Fairs as much as he does.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they don't let a lot of.
Is there no crossover, or there's just maybe there's just no crossover?
Yeah.
Other than Tim, like whereas like other like normal attendees of Renaissance Fairs, because I've been to a few. They're very. I enjoy them. Sure. They're kind of fun, but yeah. I could see the majority of I won't lie. The majority of the people there probably don't watch NBA basketball nearly as much as me. So
if he's going to San Antonio, though, I would think that.
Yeah, and he's also like 7 foot, so it might be it's like kind of hard to miss him. So I'm sure there's like a hey, who was that 7 foot guy in like the jester's outfit or whatever, and it's you know, but. As far as I know, there are no pictures of him at Renaissance Fairs, which seems
yeah. I'm googling
shocking,
right now. So. I do not see any pictures
garbage.
Of him at Renaissance Fair. So that is a yeah. There you go. Maybe he's just always in costume.
Maybe yeah. You don't know. He's like that. It's a testament to how great he was at his costume. So there you go. Good.
Yes.
Good man.
He had I forgot about this, but there was sort of the uncomfortable Halloween night photos of him and Tony Parker wearing trench coats with guns pointing them at a bald guy who had a Joey Crawford referee uniform on, which you know, a little bit uncomfortable, but managed to avoid any other than maybe like one day of social media fervor, not really so much controversy of it. I guess it's what you That's one of the benefits of being able to, stay in the back lines is you don't.
Yeah,
have
you built
to,
up some equity for many years, so you can do something like that, and people won't yes. freak out. Steven Jackson did it, maybe not.
Right? But. Yeah, not so much. Right. But so Tim Duncan did a Q&A on his Slam Duncan website, which was last updated, I believe, in 2003. So,
but it has like modern pictures. That's the best part. Is it looks like from everything you look at, it was like a website that was designed in like Front Page Express in like 2003 or whatever. That was very nerdy by as well. You got it, and like four other people got it. But
sure.
It's like a very like it doesn't fit the entire screen. It fits like a 2003 like CRT monitor or whatever. It doesn't make any. But like there's updated pictures. So like. Clearly, it has been made like at any like 2012, maybe 2014. It had been made sometime in between there, but it definitely looks like it's like from 2002 or 2003. Like it's designed like that, like whatever. It might have been just like sitting on his desk for like 6 years, and he was like, "Yeah, I like the design." There you go. And they're like, "All right, Tim, like that's fine. We'll do it." Because it just doesn't make sense on modern computers. It looks just ridiculous. Yeah. But
the latest news is what's new NBA Finals Spurs Heat, and then takes you to a link of the 2013 Finals. So
there you go. Yeah, even though like there's no way this thing like look at this like rollovers and like. It's yeah. Anybody who knows anything about web design will find it quite amusing. So.
So when he was 27 at this point, so his favorite book was Jurassic Park. His favorite
Ooh,
food.
Do we want to advertise? I just clicked their link. Webmaster at slamdunkin.com for advertising
Ooh,
opportunities.
There
you
go.
In? I'm in.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
His favorite food is steak and shrimp. Favorite ice cream flavor is gold medal ribbon.
what is that? I don't even know what that is.
He had three dogs. Nicole, Shadow, and Zen. One is a cockapoo, the other two are labs. His favorite color is black. His favorite type of music is rap and reggae. His favorite movie is The Crow. His favorite TV shows are Martin and Seinfeld. Favorite actor, Kevin Spacey. Favorite board game, Monopoly. And do you like to surf the net? Yes, I spend lots of time online. So there you go.
There you go. On the internet. On the internet. I've never heard of gold medal ribbon. I guess I don't go to Baskin Robbins. Apparently it's a... exclusive Baskin Robbins flavor, but it looks like something I would enjoy. It's vanilla and chocolate ice creams with a caramel ribbon. So there's your gold medal ribbon. Okay, yeah, I'd be down with that. So go ahead.
So yeah,
I approve of his favorite ice cream. So
there's a few stories on teammates or on opponents mentioning how nice Tim Duncan is to them. But before that, there was a good article by Kevin Arnovitz on. You know, why Tim Duncan is the most influential player in the NBA. And it just sort of talks about, there's a quote from Mike Budenholzer, who was a longtime Spurs assistant before he became Hawks coach. And he says, "We walk into our houses and thank Tim Duncan. You think about all the coaches and all the GMs and all, even the assistant video guys who are now assistant coaches, all the people who have climbed the NBA ladder. We all owe our success, our place in the league to Timmy. The magnitude of that, the number of people in this league who have enjoyed opportunity or found fortunate spots in the league, you can trace it back to this one guy, to the way Timmy played ball and conducted himself. The culture is Timmy." Which, you know, I mean, if you think about it, obviously there's situations like Kobe playing 20 years with the Lakers. There are other guys, you know, even Dirk with Dallas. But, you know, the Spurs have by far had the most stability. I mean, the Mavericks have had stability quite a bit. You know, obviously Mark Cuban's been there and Donnie Nelson. But, you know, they've had different coaches. They've, you know, haven't had necessarily the same, like, kind of, you know, situation where, you know, they have a coaching tree and they have all these assistants and they're doing all these things on the team. Whereas the Spurs, you know, have kind of created, like, this huge model and this huge culture that's, you know, been, you know, gone to other teams. You know, the Thunder, the Jazz, the Hawks, all these guys, you know, they have that kind of the Spurs model in mind. And if, you know, obviously had a level of success from doing that, although obviously without Tim Duncan, there's, you know, or a, you know, a franchise type player, there's limits to where that succeeds. But, you know, if you think about one guy being a job creator like that, I mean, I'm not sure you can say that same thing about, you know, Kobe with all the different, you know, regimes that have been in there out in Los Angeles. Not that it's Kobe's fault necessarily, but, you know, the fact that there's been, you know, those other teams, even if there's that same, that player has played there, it hasn't necessarily been that same, you know, regime that's been there, that's been able to kind of create the environment where all these guys, you know, are able to, you know, get jobs placed and kind of spread the culture to other places.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, you look at that tree and the coaching tree, and of course Pop deserves a lot of credit for that as well, of that coaching tree, but a lot of it is, you know, and Budenholzer is one of those guys that came from that and is saying that, that, you know, it's a lot of it is Duncan too, which is just an incredible testament to what those two as a unit and that entire culture that they sort of created in San Antonio have created. Like we talked about at the beginning, like, they are the best place for a reclamation project to go, and almost like you almost think, like, or there's almost no doubt that, like, that guy is going to improve, something about that guy is going to be maximized, and then a lot of those guys go on to make more money. You know, they come in as sort of their, you know, on their last leg, they come in, they get revitalized, and a lot of them go and do other things and make other money other places. But it's just so interesting to see, and it's just a testament to what Duncan and Pop have created. And it'll be interesting to see if that sort of maintains without Duncan, or if he's created such a something, you know, if he's created such a stabilizing factor there that will, you know, maintain for so long until basically every one of these guys is gone and there's a whole new regime or whatever. But as far as there is now, I mean, I have no reason to think that all of a sudden they're just going to fall apart and everyone's going to start fighting with each other and they're not going to be, you know, great at what they've been so great at. But it's just amazing what they've been able to do in San Antonio. And it, in a lot of ways, and we've talked about it a lot on this show too, it is stretched even beyond Tim Duncan as well. I mean, when David Robinson was there by himself, they were really good team too. It's crazy what that franchise has done over the last, like, 20, and now we're almost approaching 30 years of just, like, just a crazy amount of stability and just success.
Yeah. So some stories about Tim Duncan being nice. After the Spurs swept the Clippers in 2012 in the conference semis, he hung out with Chris Paul's son so he wouldn't be sad, which is awfully nice. And Etan Thomas shared a story about Duncan, or Thomas gets the ball in the post, and then Duncan blocks his jump hook, and then as running down the court, he says to me, "That was a good move, but you have to get more into my body so you can either draw the foul or I can't block it." And then he did something. So he basically, like, first he wasn't sure if he was joking or not, and then a few plays later he did it and got more into his body, and he couldn't block it. He missed the shot though, and then Duncan looked at me and said, "Much better," and kept playing. And so then he later says, "Honestly, one of the nicest guys in the NBA, one of the best power forwards ever." Also, you mentioned the Draymond Green story of talking junk. There's a similar one with Steven Adams where Adams is sort of giving him a pounding and, you know, kind of taking it to him as a rookie. And then Duncan sort of, he comes over and just talks to him a bit, and he's just like, "Hey man, how are you?" And I was like, "Oh, what a nice guy." And then he dropped 20 on me from there on. So, lulling him into the false sense of security there. So, also another fun one is, he briefly sang to Brooke Lopez on the court. Apparently, "Welcome to the Jungle" was playing over the loudspeaker. This is a game from 2010 when a Nets game and a Spurs game, obviously. And and then and Brooks' brother had watched the game, his older brother Chris, and then he's like, hey, in the middle of the fourth quarter I saw Timmy lean over and say something, what do you say? And then Brooke got a big smile on his face and he said, the speakers in the arena were playing Welcome to the Jungle, we got fun and games, and Timmy was mouthing that in his ear. So the two of them had a nice little laugh about that. So Tim Duncan the goofball, it obviously you know, a fun thing. And also I there's some good a few more things that I think were interesting about sort of the Popovich Duncan relationship. There apparently there was a decent chance of Pop being fired when the Spurs started 6-8 in 99, the lockout season. And you know, Malik Rose and Avery Johnson was both, you know, said like, you know, that they you know, seriously thought that he was going to leave. A couple other guys were a little more skeptical, like it wasn't, you know, definitely going to happen if they didn't win this game in Houston, but there was very much a sense of, you know, we need to get this on track or else, you know, he's going to be going. They ended up winning that game and going 31-5 for the rest of the season and, you know, ultimately got their first championship. You know, the other thing is that, you know, the fact that, you know, one key, I think, to the Spurs' success was the fact that Duncan was able to, you know, allowed himself to get yelled at by Popovich and took the same kind of, you know, yelling that basically forced every other player to accept it. If, you know, if Duncan was going to accept it, you know, Popovich was going to accept it. You know, and there are other times where, you know, kind of the star has to embrace that in order for everyone to kind of be able to do that. But that was, you know, I think a key of, you know, everyone else had to take it because Duncan would take it.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely something that any good culture, any, you know, if you want that, if you want it to work top down, and if you want the coach to really get every single guy and really get into, you know, or for them to listen to what the coach said, like it's so much easier. And this goes for, you know, jobs or basketball, whatever the hell it is. When you have the top guy, the top dog, whoever, you know, a Tim Duncan type, and he listens, and then it just helps it so much. And that's going to be a big thing where I mentioned, like, I don't think it's going to all of a sudden turn into, you know, a mess in San Antonio. Like, I'm not saying that at all. But having him be there and being that calming influence that would be able to take all that and would be fine with Popovich yelling at him and screaming at him or whatever, that helps. Like, that really does a lot for the entire culture of a team and for the entire success of a team, because then now the coach, you know, kind of has a little bit of power in that too, and then that player has power as well and proves that sort of he is kind of the alpha there, because he's willing to take it and sort of let other people on the team, you know, understand and see that as well. So it's a super important thing that Duncan was kind of okay with his entire career, and I think it's a big part of why they were such a successful franchise as well.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, you know, obviously Duncan has rarely been on the most popular jerseys list, but he actually did manage to crack into that in 2014. You know, it helped obviously that they're going to the finals in those couple years and won a championship. But you know, the fact that kind of people sort of came around a little bit on you know, because he hadn't been on that list since 2007, so I thought that was interesting that you know, eventually I think people embraced them. And you know, they started to you know, they obviously didn't do very well in the ratings in the early 2000s, although again that was during a downtime for the league, so that I think part of it was just the fact that it was a downtime, and you know, the Spurs were not you know, they weren't going to compare to the Lakers during that time, but it was more I think situational as opposed to the Spurs, you know, being a complete drag themselves. But you know, they obviously, you know, when they found the right opponent, like in the Heat, and you know, were battling against some of the, you know, the right team, they did actually, you know, they were a you know, maybe not the most exciting team still, but they were, you know, they were selling jerseys, they were doing kind of some of the things that they had sort of been, I don't know if criticized for exactly is right, but they had sort of been, you know, said that people wouldn't do for the Spurs. So that was kind of interesting. I think we should get a little bit into the KG rivalry and the Shaq rivalry, and then we should finish up with some of our favorite stats.
Yeah, so Tim Duncan doesn't really like Kevin Garnett, and I'm sure yes. Kevin Garnett doesn't like Tim Duncan. I think that's fair. They're kind of coy about it, but this was from an SI Vault article in 2012, kind of talking. Yeah, it's the 21 Chris Ballard Shades of Grey. Yeah. Yeah, which is a fantastic, like, absolutely a must read. And there's so much stuff out there. A lot of it that I've read has been fantastic, so I can't really like recommend you, because I'll recommend you like 15 things. But there's just so much good stuff being written about Duncan right now. But this is from that 21 Shades of Grey, and it's with Kurt Ballard. He says Duncan hates Garnett, hates him the way liberals hate Sean Hannity. Which is a fun one. Malik Rose says he fucking destroys you. Was his quote. Duncan's lifetime averages against Garnett's teams were at 19.4 points per game, 11.6 boards, and a 44-17 record, including the postseason. Yes. There's been talk from reliable sources how KG has made a career trying to punk Duncan, baiting him and slapping him and whispering stuff and just kind of messing with him. And as Malik Rose, as I mentioned there, where he says he kind of destroys him, is that Duncan, it kind of pisses him off and drives him to do well against Garnett and whatever team he's playing with. According to this one, Duncan is diplomatic about the issue, asked if perhaps all those years of battling Garnett has softened his feelings for the man, led to a Magic Larry type kinship. Duncan leaned back on his couch in his hotel room and grins. There's a pause, a longer pause. Finally, he says, "Define kinship." So,
which is great.
Pretty good way to say no.
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, the ironic thing is that, yeah, the trash talk is absolutely the wrong thing you want to do for Duncan, because you know, it just causes him to, even though he doesn't show it, it motivates him to, you know, to get fired up and to sort of destroy things. Yeah, so, yeah, and with Shaq, you know, they even though, because when they were in the playoffs, they were, it really was more of... You know, I mean, they both obviously were great big men, but Duncan was more of a power forward at that point. O'Neal was obviously center. But Sean Devaney article on the rivalry and talking about, you know, kind of like a what if Shaq had played with the Spurs and how they kind of weren't, you know, never really had that kind of epic thing. But they did play in the postseason 5 out of 6 years. They split the first two series, and the fifth went to the Lakers. In all four cases, the Spurs-Lakers winner reached the finals. Only one time they did not win the championship was the Lakers in 2004. They each won 15 postseason games against each other. Duncan averaged 25.6 points and 13.0 rebounds, while Shaq had 22.4 points and 12.8 rebounds per game. So interesting that Duncan actually slightly statistically better in those matchups, which is, you know, given Shaq's, you know, playoff reputation, I think is pretty interesting. So, and looking at the best postseason trios of all time, Duncan, Ginobili, and Parker are on that list. They have the most wins, 126, with 4 championships. Magic Johnson, Kareem, and Michael Cooper had 110 with 5 championships. Magic, Kareem, and Byron Scott have 93 wins and 3 championships. And then Bird, Mikhail Parrish have 92 wins and 3 championships. So interesting to see how they go about that. And there's one Tim Duncan quote on Ginobili and Parker that I forgot to mention that I think is worth. Duncan said in 2010, this is from a oral history of Tim Duncan from mysanantonio.com. I think it's pretty well documented. I wasn't sure what to expect from Parker. With his age, with his inexperience, with his lack of knowledge of language, all those things went into it. I think it was the same thing on a different level with Ginobili. With Parker, was about him being whatever 13 years old, obviously a joke, and asking him to start for a team that's been doing pretty good. With Ginobili, it was just getting used to playing with someone like that, taking some of the shots that he does. So it is pretty remarkable, and I couldn't find a lot in this is, I guess, a lot of Duncan not being that accessible with the media as far as, like, you know, personal tales of the three or anything that they, you know, with anything specifically about their relationship beyond that. I mean, that wasn't really that insightful necessarily, but I just thought was one of the few times on the record he actually kind of said something about the three, and I thought was worth mentioning. But obviously, you know, tremendously successful on the court, and, you know, interesting to know more about their relationship off the court. But, you know, hopefully somebody will write the Spurs book one day, or the, you know, the Pop Duncan book, or whatever you write about. Hopefully that will hopefully someone will talk eventually, and we'll get more details on, you know, everything kind of behind the scenes of them for the past, you know, 19 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you don't really don't. I mean, yeah, that is something that you don't really hear about them. Because it's something where, yeah, people, you know, maybe you get this idea that, oh, it's Parker, Ginobili, and Duggan. They were just kind of ready to go. And, like, it didn't coalesce right away. Like, you know, Parker was kind of, he was okay for a little while, but it took him a little while to get going onto that level. And Ginobili was, you know, not a very big part of the first year. And then the second year, as this year went on and as the playoffs went going, got going en route to, you know, a championship, that's when he sort of clicked. And then, you know, he was ready to go after that. But it wasn't like immediately they just draft these guys out of nowhere, bring them in, and then everyone coalesced like perfectly. It was a weird period, and we saw that like their styles and the way that team played evolved from that, where those guys came in when they were still kind of a slow prodding team. You know, Robinson was still there in a lot of ways, and then we see, you know, all the way till the late 2000s, where that team with the same guys with, you know, pretty much the same makeup then became a really quick, you know, a super quick, you know, run the floor type team. So it's just kind of interesting to see that you know, that unit had, you know, almost two different lives, and just also took a little while to coalesce and really get going. And I wouldn't say they really were off and running until, you know, I think it's safe to say maybe 2005 was when it really started to click that, like, these three are the guys and they're ready to go. You know, I don't know if it was before that, before they really, really, really got it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and, you know, Parker really broke out in a sense in 2007 when he won the finals MVP, too. I mean, yeah, he was already a star, but yeah, as far as, like, kind of being on that same level, I mean, I think he might have even been till then where he was kind of thought of as where it really was kind of, you know, like a new big three, so to speak. I don't know if it was ever marketed that way, but, you know, where basically that was kind of the, you know, they were really that trio, you know, after, you know, that came along after, you know, Robinson retired and, you know, and they kind of reshaped the team. So, where some talk about some favorite stats and some, you know, a few things about Duncan's career to kind of finish up. He had three finals MVPs, joining a club with Jordan, who had six, LeBron, Magic, and Shaq, two regular season MVPs in 02 and 03. He was 10 times on the All-NBA first team, including his rookie year, and also his last one was in 2013 at age 36. Three times in the second team, two times in the third team. 15 times All-NBA overall, is tied with Kareem and Kobe for the most in NBA history. He was a 15-time All-Defensive Team, 8 times in the first team. Somehow never won a Defensive Player of the Year.
It's a travesty.
Yeah, I think they should name the Defensive Player of the Year after him.
I agree. Yeah, even though he never won it, they should definitely name it. I think that would be the greatest thing ever, is to name it after him even though he never won. I honestly, and I'm not even joking, that's not even hyperbole. Yeah. I think that would be a great thing, because he's awesome. It's just incredible that he never won it. Yeah.
Bill Russell was the Finals MVP. They named it after him, and he never won it. And granted, it was the only time, it debuted in his last season, so he couldn't, other than that year.
But still. No, I'm with you. There's precedent there, so at least we got something there. So that's fine. I like that.
Yeah. He had, according to Ben Golliver of SI, tweeted that he had 19 straight seasons with a winning percentage of above 600 and 18 straight seasons with a PER above 21, which is obviously very good. He was one of only two players who played 1,300-plus games and had a career PER of over 24, Kareem being the other player. And only Duncan, Bird, and Jordan have won the Wooden Award, College Player of the Year, NBA Rookie of the Year, NBA MVP, Finals MVP, and All-Star Game MVP. Kind of a little bit of an odd mix of things, but
right, yeah.
Not that All-Star Game MVP is a you know, the most notable award, but interesting, you know, nonetheless. It is sort of interesting that Duncan, of all the players to win an All-Star Game MVP, Duncan is not necessarily one that I would
it's
think
about
of
what
as,
I was going to say. Like, yeah, I could see him just kind of being like, yeah, I'll just score like 2 points and I'm kind of good. Like, you guys can bring somebody else in if you want. I don't really care. But like,
yes,
he doesn't seem like, because there's some guys that like relish the opportunity of like, I'm going to throw off the backboard, I'm going to do this, I'm going to have this fun. Whereas Duncan kind of seems like, this is boring, I don't really want to be here. Like, I'll just get my 10 points and get out of here. But hey, that's good for him. Yes. I don't even recall what year. Do you remember off the top of your head what year he won the All-Star Game MVP?
I do not remember what year.
So apparently it was it left a quite the mark on all of us. So
indeed. So he was 9th all-time in MVP award shares, which you kind of like, you know, is a good indication of career value. 7th in total rebounds, 6th in blocks, 17th in points, 13th in win shares for 48, 12th in box score plus minus, and then 6th all-time in win shares and value over replacement player, which kind of rewards longevity. Mm-hmm.
I looked it up just to make sure. Sorry to interrupt. Won in 2000. Him and Shaquille O'Neal were joint MVPs. So I can see in the year 2000, Duncan still trying. You know, I'm sure he still cares about it then. Like, I was making sure it wasn't like 2005, where he's like, nah, dude, like, I don't care anymore. Like, that's, you guys do your thing. I'll come and enjoy the weekend. But yeah, I'm not going to bust my ass in this game. But 2000, I'm sure he's still trying. So there you go.
Yes. So, So Tom Haberstra tweeted that Duncan is the only player in NBA history with 100 defensive win shares and 100 offensive win shares. Basketball Reference, his 2003 playoff run was the best ever performance by win shares and value over placement player. There's a benefit to having a longer playoff run for that. So it's more comparable to like post 84. Right. But still, obviously, still a very impressive number. And we also discovered that Russell and Duncan are the only two players with 100 plus defensive win shares. Russell had 133 and Duncan had 106. So big difference there, which is pretty amazing for Russell, although it's still obviously very impressive. I mean, Duncan had more than Kareem, Olajuwon, Wilt, you know, all those guys. Something I found out was the Spurs won 1,072 regular season games in the Duncan era, which is more than several franchises, more than the Magic, more than the Hornets, more than the Timberwolves, more than the Raptors and Grizzlies, which isn't as much of a surprise because they only date, back a few years before he debuted. But
The Heat and the Magic and the Hornets have about a decade, and the Timberwolves too. Yeah, they have almost nearly a decade of a head start.
Yeah, teams started in 89 and 90. Yeah. The Heat do have more than Duncan. They have 1170, but not that much more than Duncan. And you know, they have 8 years ahead of him. So and the Spurs also had more wins in the Duncan era than Michael Jordan played games. 1039, Jordan played that number of games and 1072 wins for Duncan, which I thought was pretty amazing. Somebody tweeted me that I forgot who exactly it was, but thank you for doing that, because that was an excellent point as well. Man, that's pretty incredible. Just like we see that they win, you know, somewhere around 55 games basically every year, you know, a couple with a few years in the 60s, and obviously that accumulates a lot. But if you look at it that way, that's just kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, and one last thing, Ben Golliver, across the Tim Duncan era, the Spurs had the NBA's best defensive rating, 100.5, and it's not even close. Like, the next closest is Indiana, and they were at 103.4. Right after them was Miami at 103.5, and then Boston at 103.6. So not even close. And if you're familiar with defensive rating, you know that, you know, a difference of, you know, three is huge. Like, that's gigantic, and that it's amazing what they were able to do with Duncan as, you know, the force behind a lot of what they did on defense. But just an incredible statistical career.
Yeah, and Gulliver, a couple other things he noted was the Spurs had a 6.55 point differential during Duncan's career. The second best was Dallas with 2.73. So
jeez, yeah.
And
the range is small, by the way, for people that are wondering. Like a little over negative two, the Washington Wizards is the worst. So that range is, like, I mean, they're at 6.55, and
right,
you know,
I mean, that is basically, yes, exactly, the difference between second and last is basically the difference between first and second.
Right? It's unbelievable.
It's very close to the, yeah, wow. The Spurs won 155 more games during Duncan era than any other franchise. Dallas was second with 917. Duncan's 32 basketball reference tweeted that Duncan's 32-point, 20-rebound game one of the 2003 finals was the second best finals game score in NBA history. It was 32 points, 20 rebounds, 6 assists, and that's not even the one that, you know, that people always talk about, that the game 6 of that series, the closeout game, yeah, of that series, which we'll talk about in a minute, because that's an impressive one. Jared Dubin tweeted that the Spurs had 6 of the 15 best single season defenses of the 3-point era if you adjust to league average. So they were first, 6th, 7th, 9th, and so 6 in the top 15. So that's obviously a pretty the 04 team being the best of those.
Yeah, which funny enough, that's the team that did not win. And then the 2016 Spurs also did not win, but
yes, they were second best win. Yeah, so the 99 Spurs were the best that did win. So yeah. And Curtis Harris of Pro Hoops History, he tweeted Duncan's stat lines from his final games of the 2002 to 2006 postseasons. in 0-2 of the Western Conference semifinals, 34 points, 25 rebounds, 4 assists, 2 blocks. They lost to the Lakers in that one. In game 3, in game 6 of the 0-3 finals, the really famous stat line, 21 points, 20 rebounds, 10 assists, 8 blocks. Game 6 of the 0-4 Western Conference semifinals, again, lost to the Lakers, 20 points, 11 rebounds, 2 assists. Game 7 of the 0-5 finals against the Pistons, 25 points, 11 rebounds. And game 7 of the 0-6 Western Conference finals, Western Conference semifinals, where the game where they lost to the Mavericks we talked about, yep. 41 points, 15 rebounds, 6 assists, 3 blocks in overtime. Tom Aberstur also tweeted that his Duncan's career plus minus, including the playoffs since 1996, was exactly 10,000. Second is Dirk with a 6,700, and then third is LeBron with just a little bit below that, 66,658. So, first of all, the amazing that's just exactly 10,000. The fact that so far ahead of anybody else.
So now we know why he officially retired. That is because somebody told him that, and he went, "Oh, okay. Well, now I'm done." So.
It's pretty awesome. And then the last one, Tim, according to ESPN Stats and Info, Duncan, he had from 03 to 04, which is the last time the data was tracked, he had 945 bank shots. Number two, it was Dwayne Wade with 333. So it's
just incredible. Like that, it's perfect. It's so perfect that. I mean, that's 945 to 333. And, like, Wade does it a lot. Like, I see Wade do it a lot. And it's like, I would assume I assume that he'd be on that list, that he'd be near it. But to be that far away from Tim Duncan, it's just incredible. It's just unbelievable.
Yes. So, yeah. Anything else?
I think that's it. Yeah, I mean, I think we kind of talked about all the stats, what I sure really wanted to talk to. And I think the point that we just wanted to get across with this entire episode is that the guys... pretty interesting. Like, he led a very interesting career, and anybody that's going to kind of go, oh, he was boring, oh, he was this, like, you're just doing yourself a disservice, because there's so much out there and there's just so much to read and consume and watch or whatever. But he was such a dynamic player, and he's going to be greatly, greatly missed in the NBA. Like, I'm a guy who I've always enjoyed his game. I've always loved him. I've always kind of argued with people that are like, oh, he's boring, I hate watching him or whatever. I've always said he's a joy to watch. Like, I've loved his game from the moment I saw it, even as a kid. There was something about it. And it's admirable. It's like a guy that just wins. You know what I mean? Like, people talk about how bad they want guys to just, you know, win and not be, you know, this and not do that and not showboat. And then you get this guy, and then you're like, ah, he's boring. Well, no, you get it. Like, there you go. There's your guy. But it just wasn't, like, people just always found some flaw in him. But I think hopefully now with his retiring, people will go back and they will look. And of course, we saw that on Twitter the past few days. People are tweeting out these numbers and these stats that are just mind-blowing of how great this guy was and how just an all-time great he was. And anybody who does, I just can't fathom you not thinking that he's right there. And, you know, we talked about him last year on our Top 50 show. This is a guy that, and there's been discussions of this too, you can make a reasonable case for him. You know, I would say, you know, top 10 is a no doubt in my mind, at least all-time players. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that, like, so, and then now you get to the thing of the top, and that, you know, top five gets people a little nervous and weird, and I don't know if I'm ready to do that quite yet. I'd have to really break it down. But you can, I mean, the fact that we're having that argument about a guy that just retired is astounding. So I hope everybody enjoyed when they had greatness in front of them to watch it, because I know I did, and I loved it, and he's definitely going to be sorely missed.
Yeah, absolutely. So... all right. Well, Rich, thanks again for some fun talk about the NBA history. We always a privilege to do this with you, sir.
Yes, thank you, sir.
And thanks everyone for checking us out. You can find us at hardwoodparoxysm.com. You can find our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Over and Back NBA. We would greatly appreciate a review and a rating. You can find us on Twitter and iTunes at the handle at Over and Back NBA. And let us know what you think. Thanks for listening. And until next time, we'll be back again soon.